Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Lots of summer things to talk about today with my co-host, Burl Love.
How are you, Sherry?
I'm good. I'm fresh off a vacation.
Fresh off a vacation and jumped right back into the news.
I did. I didn't think there was going to be as much news when I planned my vacation as there was. You try and guess. I guessed wrong. Our special guest today, I do want to say before we kind of jump in, there was a lot of news last week, is Christopher Milligan. And he is the Harry Foth General Director and CEO of the Cincinnati Opera. And they're getting ready this weekend to kick off their summer season. And they have Big Paul McCartney Opera as part of the whole festival this summer. And so we're going to talk about that.
Are you going to ask him if Sir Paul is going to be on hand for said performance?
Of course I am.
I mean, that would be big news.
As a reporter, do I think he's just going to sit here and tell me? I don't. But you know what? If you don't ask the question, you won't get an answer. You never know what someone's going to say. That's a reporter trick.
That's right. You'll never get the answer if
that's
you don't
right.
ask.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, that'll be a good interview. But back to the news of the week. So you come back from Florida. You think it's going to be slow. You're working on a story about the city budget. And lo and behold, what do we learn?
You know, it's just a line item for a Greater Cincinnati Sports Authority. And I was like, I've heard this talked about for a while. We had one. It kind of went dormant in 2020. It was never... really like as big as Visit Cincinnati with tourism. You just didn't hear about it as much. And it turns out it didn't have a lot of funding. And so I literally texted friend of the show, Julie Calvert, during the budget meeting. And I was like, a sports authority? She's like, I'm out of town. I'll call you in a little bit.
I think we should call her two-time guest.
Two-time Julie Calvert. Guest. This
yeah,
is
she's,
true.
Yeah, she's getting up there in the...
In the numbers, yeah.
Yeah, in the with the five timers club.
I will have I think to have her back to talk
yes,
about this for sure.
Because
this is,
yeah.
I did consider this, not that the budget itself
and
is not big news.
For those who don't know, she heads the convention and our
CEO,
CBG.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
president.
Of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, which we call Visit Cincy, right?
Yes. And so, which is a nice pithy name as opposed to what it was used to be. So that I always like that for headline writing. But anyway,
right.
She really confirmed this and talked about what this was going to look like. And it's going to be all rebranded. It's going to have its own director. It's going to work in tandem with Visit Cincy. But this is really the kind of organization, I guess, the top 50 markets for sports in this country all have one, except us.
So it's going to focus the effort to bring sporting events to our market.
Yes. For instance, we've written about, and it's kind of like, you know, we're really hoping to get the NFL draft here in Cincinnati. Well, the NFL would deal with the city sports authority to make that happen if it were to happen. And we
rather
don't really have one.
Coming in and starting with Visit Cincy
like
or starting with the Bengals.
That's something they just planned with the Bengals. This
then
is
they got to go to the
city
then,
event.
Yeah. So this pulls in governments, obviously, because they are going to pony up some money. The city of Cincinnati and their budget approved or is about to approve how much?
$250,000
to get this thing going.
Visit Cincinnati is committing $500,000 for 3 years each. You know, it's all not set in stone. So I feel like there might be some other funding that kind of comes through. There's license plate fees too that can come in, like if you get certain license plates. She said by the end of the summer, this is all going to be set and in place. And so we're going to be watching this unfold.
I mean, my first reaction to it was, you know, this is great. Why did it take so long? We need this to compete. But then my second thought, and I'm talking like immediate second thought was, okay, you have this group. There's going to be a head, I'm sure, of the sports authority. Wonder who's going to get that job.
Agree.
That'll be fun to watch. An insider, an outsider. We'll see. But you begin discussions about, let's say it's NCAA tournament, basketball tournament, you know, round one or two.
We're always disappointed when we don't
or
get
something
those.
Like that.
Of course, what do we need?
Well, what's going to happen is they're going to say, yes, you know, we have these great hotels, we have these great restaurants, we have this, you know, a decent transportation infrastructure. and they say, well, good, let's see the court, let's see the arena, let's see the venues. And then it's going to be wah, wah, wah. And we take them to the Heritage Bank Center,
so,
a.k.a.
Riverfront
Coliseum.
This conversation is starting to get really real about, you know, needing an arena.
It was a long way of me asking you, do you think the Sports Authority will put more force behind the effort to address Cincinnati's need for a more modern, marketable state or arena?
I do, because the business community is involved in this too, which I should have said earlier. And they know that we need this to attract the big things. And they are concerned. They want, it's part of the reason for the whole convention center district. It's everybody thinks that the city needs us to be, to compete with other cities. We need all of these things. And yes, they're expensive and yes, they're hard to do. But it has to be talked about. And things in the city, they start like tepid, like, oh, we need an arena. I mean, we're going back to like, when 2016, like, oh, we didn't get the Republican convention, not 2016, 2006. This is a long time ago, because we needed a new arena. And the conversation really started then of what that would look like. And now by the end of the summer, we should have the arena study back that's being led by the chamber. And what that says and how it can be paid for and what it could look like and whether the city can sustain one without a major tenant.
I think that's been the big, you know, where people kind of draw the line that, you know, there's some people that say you don't need a anchor tenant like an NBA basketball team, that there are enough, there's enough business to get, you know, from concerts and other, you know, events to make it worthwhile. And others are just saying this is wasted money. If you don't have an anchor tenant, it's doomed to fail. I haven't talked to enough people to make up my own mind about that, but I'm leaning towards, you know, that if you build it, they will come. Not that all of a sudden an anchor tenant like an NBA team or an NHL team pops up, but you're going to get nowhere if you just rely on, what is it, more than 50-year-old?
Exactly. We have one and it hasn't been taken care of as it needs to be, and it really is time. That said, one of the things that I there's just no way it's not going to have public funding. I can't imagine that. I could be wrong, but it is for a different kind of audience. Like, it's an audience that wants the concerts, because in this community, we have the professional sports teams and there's so much focus on them, rightly so. I'm not saying that it's not, but the arena is for a different audience that also lives here and wants to see these big concerts. And so the arena is so much more than just sports. It's there for tourism, but it's there for the music community too. And people who want those things, they shouldn't have to go to Columbus and Louisville. They live here. And so I think that it offers just something else.
All right. And very quickly, we should, you know, stick a fork in this discussion because it's done. Connected communities.
It is. It passed 6-3. Last week, we heard a lot of the same voices that we heard in Planning Commission. I was on vacation. I followed along a little bit, but I didn't watch it live, which everyone who was with me was shocked. But that was my vacation. I needed a little break. But I went back and kind of looked at everything. And it was the same arguments that we've heard all along. But just, you know, the three council members, Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, Scotty Johnson, and Victoria Parks, really just felt like it didn't have all of the things that it needed to consider to make the neighborhoods happy. And they weren't necessarily like, no, I hate connected communities. They're like, they just felt like it really took some more work, but so much work went into it that the other council members are like, no, this is it. This is it. And so it passed.
Well, we got our share of guest columns, letters to the editor, people not comfortable with the plan for various reasons. I mean, everything from, and what we're talking about, if you haven't been following along, is the city has updated its zoning in key areas. They are going to change what would have been single family structure requirements and allow multifamily units along transportation corridors and different areas. And central business districts, which on its face seems like, okay, that's a great idea. But people who actually live there have said things like, we didn't get to provide enough feedback. We're concerned about parking. People who are more from the fair housing arena have said, you know, or affordable housing have said, you know, this is a hope and a dream. If you think just allowing for more density is going to make housing more affordable in these neighborhoods, you know, you don't have the data, you don't have the track record to prove that. So there's a lot of trepidation. But I think what I took away from, you know, we had an editorial board discussion with the mayor. I have had phone calls and emails from people who are concerned about it. I think that the big takeaway I have is that nothing is going to happen overnight, that this will be gradual. This will be project by project. There will be time to let this evolve. I don't think there's been any similar metro area that has not modified its zoning over time. And so if it's not working or if there's issues, it's not like there's going to be a switch one day and all of a sudden there's going to be all these, you know, Cincinnati quads all over the place. You know, this is going to be a more gradual approach, but something that the administration, the mayor, and a majority of city council feel is necessary. So do you think that's an accurate assessment, Sherry? Do you think?
I do. And I want to say my biggest takeaway, my biggest surprise takeaway from everything is I could predict how people from different neighborhoods would react, but I didn't really expect that the people that were for it would be much younger. And it really showed me it's almost, they're looking for a different kind of housing. And they didn't necessarily come forward and say, I need affordable housing. Now, that was a whole conversation around this, so I don't want to discount that. But when I'm speaking about the young people in general, they're thinking about how they want to live in this city, and they don't necessarily want to own a single family home. They want to live in different kinds of places than we have now and other cities do have, and they want to live in more dense places. And so to me, we really were looking towards the future, but that's the biggest surprise out of everything that I did see. And my other takeaway is, are we seeing a re-engagement from the community? Because like a year and a half ago, if you asked me if the railroad was going to be the biggest issue of last year, I would have said definitely, yes, this is going to be a big issue. And so many people were engaged. But if you asked me at the beginning of this year, is this how connected communities would go? I would have said no, that it's a zoning ordinance. Okay, everyone. And I wouldn't have expected this level of engagement. So is it because it was such a big issue, with such a big change to the zoning, that it was kind of as big as the railroad? Or are we in a time of seeing a re-engagement of City Hall and the issues that affect all of our communities and neighborhoods? So I'll kind of be looking at like the next big thing and what this engagement looks like. Are we in a new era of engagement?
It appears we are, but time will tell.
So.
All right. Is it time for you to interview Christopher Milligan?
Yes.
All right. Let's go to special guest time.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited to welcome, really on the cusp of the opera season beginning, the Harry Fath General Director and CEO of the Cincinnati Opera, Christopher Milligan. Welcome.
Good morning. Good to be here. Thank you.
I'm excited to have you. Lots of news out of the opera, which is not a sentence we say all the time, but it's a super exciting sentence to say. So we thought this would be a good time to have you.
It's our 104th season.
Wow.
Which is amazing. We are the second oldest opera company in the U.S. And there's a rich history there, which we can get into when you're ready.
I would like to talk about that. I'm a little bit worried at this point that I've heard that at various opera balls being said aloud.
Sure.
And I didn't remember that fact, suggesting how fun your events are.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so we have this. I always just feel so lucky that Cincinnati has a symphony, the Pops, an opera, a ballet.
A music hall.
Yes, we're so lucky. But the second oldest, tell me about that.
So Cincinnati Opera was founded in 1920. And what we always say about the operatic art form is that it's the ultimate team sport in the world of arts. It's the coming together of all of the performing and even visual arts, but we have an orchestra, we have singers on stage, soloists, a chorus, we have visual components in terms of costumes and sets and lighting. But in 1919, there was an experiment that was done, and this was at the Cincinnati Zoo, believe it or not, where there was an outdoor pavilion appropriate and regularly used for performances, and it was the coming together of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra and also the Cincinnati Conservatory, and then the Cincinnati Zoo. All three entities came together and put on an opera festival season in the summer of 1919 as an experiment. And then the company, Cincinnati, outside, okay. Yes, very much outside, and sometimes over the years in competition with the other performers at the zoo, if you will. Particularly, I think we hear about peacocks and seals. And So the season started in 1920 and then persisted at the zoo until 1971, the oldest summer festival in the U.S. and, as I said, the second oldest company in the U.S. as well, just after the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Ours, though, was the coming together of these very Cincinnati organizations to start this tradition. There had been traveling companies that had been through Cincinnati and had performed at some of the old theaters that no longer exist. Thankfully, Music Hall still exists. As I always say, you know, a lot of cities tore down their music hall and replaced it with something in the 1970s. But here in Cincinnati, we have Music Hall. It's beautiful and has been our home since 1972 when the company moved into an indoor facility with air conditioning. That's a big issue.
Helpful in the summer.
Especially in the summer, right? And then also the ability to produce at a completely different theatrical level indoors.
So you have been the director for 4 years. That's during the pandemic. Did you start?
March 1st, 2020. Okay.
So you've put on an outdoor opera. Is that right?
We did.
In Blue Ash and yes. Summit Park?
So you probably have done the math. 1920 means that our 100th anniversary was 2020.
Yes.
And oh my gosh, Sherry, we had so much planned and zero of it happened.
Oh, that's so hard.
But we came back strong in 2021 with a season at Summit Park in Blue Ash. And it was, you know, configured during pandemic times with everyone socially distanced and squares throughout the lawn there in front of the stage.
It is one of the most amazing events that I have ever been to. I think because it was so special, because there yes. were so few events at the time, but to be able to have a picnic and be outdoors with the quality of the mm-hmm. music. I don't know how you did that.
We had the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra on stage with our performers, and we did, I think, 9 or 10 performances our entire season outdoors there in Summit Park. And you're so right that people were eager to be reminded that there's this thing called opera and this thing called performing arts and coming together. One of the things many of us talk about is how joyful it was. And then especially to see folks on the perimeter, they didn't have tickets maybe, but they just kind of showed up and they're like, wait, I hear there's something going on over there. And they check it out and it's like amazing. You know, we did Carmen and the Barber of Seville and Tosca, really extraordinary. We'll look back on that for years and years to come with, nevertheless, we produced a season and what a joyful experience that was. 2022, we came back into Music Hall and been producing there since, of course.
So I do like your personal story. So you're intern to CEO, right?
That's right.
Not a direct path, but close. Yes. So
not an immediate path.
Okay. So when did you interned when?
I was an intern in the summers of 1989 and 1990. And so I was a student at Miami University. I applied to be an intern in the production department. And just really was so wowed by the history and tradition and quality of the Cincinnati Opera's performances, and fell in love with the company then and just I remember thinking even still today, oh gosh, if there's any way at some point that I could work for Cincinnati Opera, that would be amazing. Life goals.
I love stories like that.
Yeah, it was terrific. Was,
when you went to college, what was your career path?
Did you I started in economics and finished with a degree in music and then immediately went into working in the arts. I had no idea what I was going to do. Worked in arts education in my hometown, which is Dayton, and then got a call in 1997 from the from Patty Beggs, who was the marketing director, had moved into the role of the lead administrative position, and she asked, would you be interested in doing marketing for the opera? And I said, yes. Yes, please. So that was 97. And so it has just been, I mean, every day is fresh and new and different. And just, you know, to come out of the Washington Park garage up the stairs and to see the big reveal of Music Hall, it's just inspiring every single day.
See, amazing. That's so Cincinnati.
Yes.
Like to be able to have
absolutely.
That. And I love just see what you go to a park and Music Hall is just there and beautiful and.
Yeah, so amazing. When we have folks visit from other communities, they're always just wowed by like, how did I not know that this was here? Both the quality of the park itself is just so beautiful. And then the hall is, it's enormous. It's as big as the Paris Opera. It's, you know, built around the same time as well. My office.
With the chandelier. Your office is in Music Hall.
My office is in Music Hall, and I have a window that looks out into Washington Park. And nearly every time I look, someone's taking a photo. Sometimes it's a wedding party outside of Music Hall. It's an icon of our community.
And tours. There's all kinds of tours all the time. You see them outside and inside.
Architecture tours, ghost tours. You can do it all.
I mean, I guess I have to ask now. Have you ever seen a ghost?
I have never seen a ghost. Okay. There are some crazy stories, though.
I know. I've heard. And yeah. It's like some of them you don't really want to doubt. And you're just like, it is part of our lore.
Yeah.
So this year, this season starts this weekend? This coming weekend, yes?
Tomorrow night.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. We're recording on Wednesday. I always lose track of the days.
Sure.
June 12th. So it starts tomorrow night. Okay. Mm-hmm. And tell us about this season.
So this season we open with Mozart's opera, Don Giovanni. And I just saw the dress rehearsal for that last night. It's going to be amazing. It's a new production, which for us means new sets and new costumes. And this will premiere tomorrow night, 7:30. It'll run for two performances, Thursday and Saturday. And then we're so much of the season overlaps internally. Externally, you see there are performances here and here and here throughout the schedule. But internally, there's so much going on in terms of set building and rehearsals, orchestra rehearsals, staging rehearsals, costume fittings, wig fittings, makeup. There's an enormous amount of activity that's, you know, buzzing backstage with Music Hall.
Has everyone recovered from doing Madame Butterfly? Last year, all of the people that you just mentioned, are they recovered from that?
Yeah, for sure.
That was so visually
for sure.
Just incredible.
I mean, honestly, the season feeds us. It's what we work all year long for this amazing summer festival season. And so it is both exhausting and at the same time invigorating. It's a strange phenomenon. So after Don Giovanni, we have the classic opera La Traviata, which is Giuseppe Verdi, the composer. It's the opera that was featured in Pretty Woman and is... always pulls the heartstrings.
It
charming,
does.
Charming piece with gorgeous, beautiful music that many people recognize. And then we finish the season with something that not only have we never done before, but no opera company has ever done before, which is the world stage premiere of Paul McCartney's Liverpool Oratorio. And I was just thinking this morning, we have a page in our program book that lists our repertoire. And so it starts with composers whose name began with A and then goes all the way to Z. But there's never been an entry for a composer, a songwriter named Paul McCartney before, and this year there is. So this is an amazing, amazing project that that has been underway for a number of months with regard to set design, costume design, and set building.
Tell me how that kind of came to be, because this is called the Liver You pronounce it, please.
Liverpool Oratorio. The Oratorio. Proper name is Paul McCartney's Liverpool Oratorio. It was a piece that was commissioned by the Liverpool Philharmonic in 1990. They were anticipating their an anniversary season. They commissioned Paul McCartney, local composer. They said, would you be willing to write a piece for us? And he has said subsequent to that, you know, I could have written just a string quartet, or I could have written a piano piece, but he went big and like 10x big. So it's a piece that features four soloists, and the initial cast for the recording and the premiere were world-class soloists doing the performance, a boy choir, and then a choir of 48 voices. And these are, I always like to point out, these are voices that they could all have their own solo career. So it's an enormous like wall of sound when they're all singing along with the full orchestra, right? And so the piece premiered in 1991, and it was recorded, and the commercial recording was released and did really well, but it's only ever been performed in concert. So a few years ago, when we were making plans for the 2024 season, we were looking at the budget and said, you know, we just really need something that is going to have a much broader appeal than traditional operas. We do great with Carmen. We do great with La Boheme. But there's a special opportunity when it comes to something like this. And we reminded ourselves that in 2018, we did something called Another Brick in the Wall, which was an adaptation, an opera made from Pink Floyd album, The Wall. And we had such a great success with that. And we wondered...
It really does open it up to other people exactly. who are Pink Floyd fans or That's rock right. fans of That's being right. like, well, what is this?
Here's one astonishing statistic about that particular production. 50% of the audience was new to file.
Oh, wow.
Brand new. For some of them, their first time to music hall, which is amazing and excellent. And so we had that experience and we thought, well, what do you follow that with? What, you know, we kind of did a deep dive into the repertoire and other projects that we were familiar with and made a list of things. And I had recalled when I was in college that there were a number of popular music songwriters who were dabbling in classical music. And that's, you know, Billy Joel was doing that a little bit, Stuart Copeland, and also Paul McCartney. And so I had seen an announcement that Paul McCartney was going to be commissioned to write this piece. And then it mentioned to some of the singers, and I was like, wow, that's going to be something extraordinary. Maybe it will be the link between popular music and classical music, which for too long has been these just separate worlds. And so the piece came out. It initially was a great success. And as I said, it's just been done in concert. So we took a look at that and said, well, is there enough of a story there to be worthy of a presentation on stage with costumes and set design? And it turns out that there is, and it's going to be extraordinary. It's about 100 minutes long. There's no intermission. It runs all the way through. And will be a great introduction for many people to.
So this is the first time it's been performed on stage.
That's correct.
So it's been the music all That's of this right. time.
Yeah.
How so involved have, has he been? Is right. he like your best friend now? Like, how does this work?
Let me give him a call. So we had the idea, and we knew the next question would be, would the publisher release the rights, allow us to do this? And so we reached out, and they needed to, of course, check with him directly. We did not speak with him initially. And the response was, isn't this from him? We heard through the publisher, isn't this the same company that did Another Brick in the Wall? And we're like, wait, Paul McCartney knows about Another Brick in the Wall? That's amazing. And he was not only intrigued, but in the end, enthusiastic about the idea of a stage adaptation of this, or a stage presentation of this. So it has been just a really amazing project from the outset. It's one of those projects where just everything kind of is falling into place so beautifully with each step that we take to bring this to July the 18th, which is when it premieres.
So what is the timeline? Like, when did you ask for approval? When did you get approval?
This was just over a year ago that we were in. We began conversations.
Did he have to like sign off on it and approve as you went along?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Not only that, he also has written a very, very sweet letter to me and to Evans Mirages, our artistic director, just endorsing the project and saying he has confidence in our moving forward with it and in the presentation.
And so there is a big campaign. It's so catchy. Get yes. Paul to Music Hall.
Yes.
How's that going?
Come together, Cincy, get Paul to Music Hall. So we are working with so many community partners, from the mayor and the Convention Visitors Bureau.
It's been fun to see on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, people are really having fun with it. I think that we want to demonstrate that Cincinnati not only would welcome a return visit by Paul McCartney, but really with open arms and with such such an embrace and enthusiasm that, he just has to come.
All right, so you don't have an answer just yet.
We don't have an answer
just yet. Or if you
do,
you're not saying.
Well, you know, from the outset, his position was, look, if I'm still around and I'm not on tour, I'll be there.
We're good on both points, correct?
We are good on both points. Okay, yes, okay. I think all right. That's
you
right.
You have to read the tea leaves.
Yeah. I'll tell you what my mental picture is of that night.
Tell
so,
me. Okay.
Right. So, our tradition when a new work is presented is to invite the composer on stage, if it's a living composer. Now, most operas, Mozart's been gone a long time. Giuseppe Verdi's been gone a long time. But we would be so pleased and just amazed. You can picture this. The cast comes out for their bow, paginated bow. So one by one, they come out and then all of them grasping hands and taking a bow. And then they pause for just a moment, gesture to the wings, and I can just see it. Out comes Sir Paul McCartney to take his bow. And by that point, I know the audience is going to love the piece and they'll already be on their feet, but I can just imagine the roars of approval and delight when I can see it.
I agree with this. And the campaign did convince me to buy tickets. So yes. You guys, so you'll have to keep listening because I'll review how much of this has come true.
Absolutely.
After its debut, which I'm very excited for.
Absolutely.
So you're in the thick of it, right? You're in the thick of this, right? With that. And this is very obviously, I think it garnered some national attention that this is happening here. Are you planning for next year then? Like in the same moments?
Yes and no. The next year's already settled.
Okay.
Right. And so we're actually, there are many, many details to get sorted, but we've got the lineup. We've got the budget set for 25. We're already into 26 and planning for 26 and a little bit 27 as well too.
In the scheme of things, how big is Liverpool for like what? How it all comes together.
Oh, for us, this is as big as it gets. So we're, you know, what are the metrics? It's among the larger budgets. It's as big as an AIDA budget. It is five performances in Music Hall. I mentioned that we're just doing two performances of Don Giovanni. So we expect a very significant crowd for this. And then just as you mentioned, in terms of media attention and interest. It is the first thing that anyone says to me, you know, if they're talking, if we're just chatting about the opera season, and I heard about the McCartney project, right? And so we're delighted to bring something that's so, you know, universally familiar to people and to introduce really the art form. I should say a couple other things about it because it's obvious to us with regard to this piece, but I should mention it. First, it's in English. So most operas are presented in their original languages. And so in the case of Don Giovanni, it's in Italian, as is La Traviata. And what we do is we project project titles in what I think of as the shortest movie screen you could imagine. We project titles above the stage.
It's helpful. I wish that I didn't have to think that it is helpful, but it is helpful when I see the opera.
Everyone reads the titles. I know, these are like subtitles, but they're above the stage. We used to call them sir titles or super titles, but now we just call them titles. And but Liverpool is in English. We'll still feature titles as well, so people can be sure to follow every word. So that's one note. I mentioned that it's short, so it's 100 minutes. Opera has a reputation for presenting some very long works that can be more than 3 hours of music, which is amazing.
But then you get the intermissions.
Right.
Have fun during intermission.
So it's sure to be really, I think, very appealing and kind of a great entry point sort of experience for folks.
How important is it that Cincinnati does still, we have an opera? Like, it's very, I'm sure it's very expensive to have something like this, especially with all of the arts that we have in Cincinnati. Sure. So how important is this to the city?
Yeah. First off, I'll just say that it works because of the community, because of the support that there is within the community. And that goes back to longtime legacy support from 10 and 20 and 30 years ago. But we always give a big thank you to Mrs. Nippert for her vision in supporting the arts. But the other way that it works is because of our collaborative relationships with the CSO, with CAA, Cincinnati Arts Association, and the Hall, and then also Cincinnati Ballet. We featured dancers in many of our productions. It is to have a symphony orchestra, the CSO no less, a ballet company, an opera company, the theater tradition that we have in our community, the art museums, it's all part of this really important kind of character to the, it's part of our identity as a community. It is what attracts people to move their businesses to Cincinnati, to be able to engage and hire tremendous employees and workforces. Of course, we think that it is the ultimate art form and the ultimate expression of the performing arts. But you're right that not every community has this, has an opera company. And to say nothing really of the level of production that we produce.
What goes into bringing new opera goers into the fold?
So we have for years always targeted our messaging to new audiences. And so you've seen, I think, some of our imagery. We've used illustrations for years because we think that there's something that's really evocative there. And that's as opposed to featuring headshots of star singers, for example, or you know, any other images you might imagine. So these help to tell a story. And the best way to get any audience engaged is to tell the story. What is the story of the opera? So we've always been focused on that. And then we have a number of direct programs that are associated with opportunities for students to come, opportunities for teachers to engage and introduce opera to their students. So it's very much focused in that direction, and it happens that that works for our regular audience as well. So we try to overlap that messaging a bit, but it's the combination of the imagery and the stories. And then we are mindful of producing a seamless kind of experience for audience members when they come to see performances. We're always looking for ways to fine tune the experience, and that's everything from parking. Your favorite topic,
it
right?
It is. You must have listened to this podcast.
We talk about
parking all the time in Cincinnati.
Right, from parking to the intermission experience. And we often do special drinks at intermission that are associated with the performances, thematic kind of opportunities. So it's all part of a package, and it has been working. I mean, young professionals love to at least give opera a try. And from there, many of them continue to come back and they say, hey, you know, I was really either moved by that, or I was wowed by the magnitude of the experience. One other thing I meant to mention is our singers sing without microphones. And that's kind of mind blowing for folks in a hall that
seats that large.
You know, thousands of people. They perform on stage and are heard over the orchestra without microphones. It's part of the training that that opera singers embark on.
So you do the casting of the shows, the Cincinnati Opera.
So our artistic director, Evan Smirages, is responsible for all of the casting. And we think of it as it's not a roadshow. So it's unlike what happens with the Broadway series, that it goes from community to community. These productions you'll see in Cincinnati will happen only in Cincinnati. Only for this one time are these particular singers coming together to do this particular work with this particular set, these costumes and so forth. So yes, it's always, you know, it's a little like summer camp. All the singers come in from really all over the world. And
it's fun because sometimes you see them out.
Yes, absolutely.
And you kind of tend to know who they are then.
Absolutely. They're night owls, all of them, I think.
Yes.
They kind of have to be.
Okay, so you have your dream job now. Yes,
I do. Yeah.
It seems like you can hear it in your voice. Yeah. And that's one of my favorite things about the podcast is I could interview people until I'm blue in the face and write stories. And I love to do that. Mm-hmm. But I love when people can just share their passion and you can hear it in their voice.
I never think I have to do this job. I get to do this job.
That's how I feel about my job.
Yeah, so true. Yeah, amazing.
All right. So how can people buy tickets?
Yeah. So probably the easiest way is our website, cincinnatiopera.org. We have a call-in box office as well, Monday through Friday, 12 to 5. And you can 513-241-ARIA or 241-2742 to be able to purchase tickets. And I just want to say, if you call in, our box office staff is the best. And you can really just start off by saying, I've never been before. What should I wear? Where should I sit? How does this work? What time should I arrive? And they can kind of walk you through the whole thing. It come at 6:30 and there's a presentation beforehand and you can get insights into the opera. Evans does a half hour presentation, often with special guests. Here's the story of the opera. Here's what you should listen for. And then the performances generally start an hour later. And
I did not know this.
Yeah,
there's
you can
the
do
little
that.
Pre.
So our box office, this team is really tremendous and a great resource for people to help them decide, you know, where they should sit. And, you know, there are so many different experiences you can have in music hall and seating locations.
It's very true. Yeah. Although there's no bad seats now.
Yeah.
So thankfully, we could spend the whole podcast
talking about the renovation. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. What a treat. Thank you so much.
One of my favorite parts of doing the podcast is hearing people's voices and the passion about their jobs. And that all came through so much. So that I was happy to hear the passion for the opera. And it really got me excited to go to all the operas this year and not just one.
You're going to become an opera enthusiast?
I might. I do enjoy going every year. I try and go to at least one of each of our arts because I like to support the arts like every year. And then it's good to be engaged in our community. So I try and go to at least one of each venue that we have. This year's was an easy choice.
Yeah, for sure.
But I might want to do more.
All right. Well,
it's summertime.
It's summertime.
You can't see us, but we're both pretty tan. And also, there's a lot of summertime news.
There is some summertime fun news. So, you know, there are some weeks where the That's So Cincinnati moments are so plentiful, I don't know where to start. But Let's start.
February, just in case everybody wants to know. There are times when Burl and I are like, the guest is here. We know what news we want to talk about. And it's like, do you have a moment? No, I didn't do anything. Do you have a moment? But it's in the summer is always hard to pick.
We have to start. Let's start with this.
Okay.
Because it's been a while since this happened. But if you were watching the Reds game last night, like I was on TV, all of a sudden, I'm trying to remember who was up to bat. Stewart, Fairchild is up to bat.
Were you watching?
I was watching.
Okay.
And he, all of a sudden, the umpire waves his hand and Stewart Fairchild like takes five steps back and you can tell like something has just happened. And John Sadek, the voice of the Reds on TV, you hear him say something to the effect of, oh, and we have an idiot running on the field. So, of course, in this modern era of sensible broadcasting, Unlike when people were streaking in the 70s and the cameras all turned on them, the cameras did not turn on this individual who had run onto the field in a Johnny Bench jersey. But I went to Twitter immediately, and it did not disappoint.
It did not. I could not sleep last night. I went down a rabbit hole with this.
Within seconds, there were videos posted of this young man who we know now because he had to stay in court today.
He didn't just jump on the field.
No, you want to describe it, Sherry?
He jumps on the field. The police officer, I mean, there's officers there for a reason because you don't know what's going to happen. It is really, it's about safety.
Oh, yeah.
And so kind of chases after him. And in the running of this chase, the person who jumped on the field did a backflip.
And nailed it. Stuck the landing.
Impeccable backflip.
Yeah. Almost backflipped into the pursuing officer, we might add.
Judge William Mallory this morning did say everyone thinks she landed the backflip. That is the takeaway from it.
So, I mean, this is sort of lighthearted in some ways, but in some ways not, because this is felony trespassing.
Where did the backflip come from, though? It is.
You want to linger on the backflip.
Adult man did a backflip. Can you do a backflip? I can't do a backflip.
I can do I used to do backflips off a diving board into a pool.
Right.
And never once entered the water correctly.
He didn't just do one. He did one on the move. And then he got tased and he went right down.
Maybe we should bring him in for special guest time just to talk about what were you thinking?
I mean, I did have so many questions. Like, what was he thinking? What was the officer thinking? What was the officer thinking when the backflip happened? What did the Castellinis think?
Well, and back in the day, if you did this, you know, the worst that could happen to you as far as, you know, when you're being apprehended is that you would get tackled or gang tackled. No, he was tased.
He was.
So after his backflip, and he tried to keep running. All of a sudden, he hit the ground like.
I mean, a takeaway is
a pile of rocks.
You don't want to be tased. Like, you kind of know it, but when you see it, you don't want to be tased.
You know, you used to be a cop reporter. Did they tase you just for, you know, in the pursuit of journalism?
I did. I know reporters have done that, and I never did take them up.
But
I
do think. Why would you want to be tased?
It's dangerous.
Yeah, and why would you want to? Yeah, but anyway. So yeah, felony trespassing. I'm thinking, okay, I know they have to make an example if they don't, you know, clamp down on this. You run the risk of other people trying
to
do it.
Exactly, especially for social media moments like this, there is an attraction to
it. Do you think the felony will stick? I sure hope not, because is he like not going to be allowed to vote because he ran onto the field at a Reds game?
I mean, it still could remain the felony, but he could get probation. It just depends.
But I mean, a felony is a felony. That's you know, that affects your ability to get a job, your employability. Again, you might not be able to vote.
If I had to guess, and again, this is me talking from just not sleeping and watching things on social media, that it became a felony at a certain point for a certain reason. Because this doesn't necessarily say to yourself, this is a felony. If I would bet money on the idea that this once upon a time was a misdemeanor, something very serious happened and it became a felony.
Maybe. All right. Well, that was a nice moment. And then an interesting development today. We learned that Braxton's Garage Beer, which has, I don't want to say spun off, but they have put Garage, formed a partnership to focus especially on the marketing and the investment and the growth of Garage Beer, which is a delightful beer. It's one of my summer favorites. Has some pretty high profile investors all of a sudden.
The Kelsey Brothers.
The Kelsey Brothers. And you, was it you or producer Phil with the eagle eyes that...
So when we went to the Kelsey Brothers did the live podcast, and it was it was such a great night.
There was some beer chugging.
There was some beer chugging, and I glanced at the picture in the story, and I was like, you know, I'm not that big of a beer drinker. I've said that here before, but Silent Phil, our producer, is, and you see in that he was chugging beer there. He did just graduate from college in a ceremony, so that seemed appropriate, and he's chugging a beer, and I was like, is that a Garage beer? And Phil says, yes, it was.
He said, yes. He did the forensic investigation.
He did. And so I think there was some
Phil's just not a beer fan.
That's
enthusiast.
True.
He's a brewer.
Yes.
I have proudly served Phil's beer at Enquirer Christmas parties.
But there was foreshadowing at...
Oh, because Jason Kelsey was slamming a garage beer. I think they both were, weren't they?
The moment I remember really was Travis. More Travis.
Okay.
It was quite a scene. But he just graduated from college in a really nice moment.
Now let's drink beer
after I graduated.
He didn't just graduate from college. Here's what really happened. They graduated. They finished their coursework. They had never received their diplomas in a commencement ceremony. So when they were at UC recording the live podcast, which you went to, and it was like, you know, theater in the round,
totally.
You know, a big fun live event. UC President Neville Pinto wearing his, you know, fancy robes and that Chef Boyardee.
People had already left
black
hat. Because they took a minute to set it up. People had left and it was like a surprise moment. And
took
he
the
comes
opportunity
out.
Of the Kelseys being back on campus to give them their diplomas. So.
And it was a nice moment for them.
It was.
But it was also fun.
Donna
was the tears. It was really sweet. It was a sweet moment.
Mama Kelsey?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway. So. Yeah.
Also, you guys, and I have no confirmation of this, but it is the podcast, so I'm just going to say it. I heard Taylor was here. We did everything we possibly could do to say, was Taylor Swift here? We checked with police department. She definitely was nowhere in view of this podcast.
You mean 2 months ago or whatever it was when they did
the live thing,
the live podcast? What was she wearing, like a disguise, like glasses and a big hat?
Stage, and I was just in a normal person seat because I just bought tickets. I think that she was here. I've heard a lot of behind-the-scenes rumors.
I think this is just Cincinnatians, you know, hoping and dreaming. And okay, you know, this is not a video podcast, but Sherry just gave me the wink, like, oh, I know it's true, but I can't say. I'm going to call BS on that. I think it'd be impossible to keep that a secret. Impossible.
But it isn't a secret.
Oh, so she was here.
I know
you're
a lot
saying
of stuff.
You're saying she was actually here.
I do think 100%, that.
No, guys, not.
No, I can't because.
Can you confirm
I know,
or deny?
No, because you like me. When I have anonymous sources, what do you like?
I need to know who they are.
And there need to be two of them.
Right. We have to triangulate.
And they both have to be willing to say, I will be a source.
And they have to be independent sources.
Correct.
The two anonymous sources.
Totally,
here we are getting into some wonky journalism ethics.
Totally support this, though.
The two anonymous sources cannot be connected where one is saying, oh, yeah, I heard source A, anonymous source A told anonymous source B. No,
correct.
They each have to have.
Can I support this?
Because
you can
knowledge.
Sleep, you guys.
All right, so
I get annoyed sometimes, but then, you know, you can sleep at night because you really have it. And you only do it on the biggest stories that no one does want to talk about. But again, I can't get anyone to even be a source on this. So that's why I have never mentioned this to you.
I see. Well, now we're going to have to actually run this story down because
the trending news team's going to
kill me. We have floated it out there into the podcast atmosphere. So, all right. Well, should we wrap this up?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you for listening to That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati is sponsored this week, and this is a bonus sponsorship by Beacon Orthopedic Sports Medicine, who is also sponsoring the Enquirer's High School All-Star Sports Awards, which is next Monday. If you would like to sponsor an episode listened to by thousands each week, email me personally at belove@cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati was produced today by Phil Didion. Lisa Gillespie books our guests. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and share us with a friend.
And finally, if you value local journalism, please consider a digital subscription to The Enquirer. Just click on subscribe at the top of Cincinnati.com. And remember, I was drowned, I was washed up, left for dead, I fell down to my feet, and I saw they bled. Yeah, yeah.